Their mobile piece reached the big equatorial line, rerouted the year before to avoid the crisy ice, and they shunted onto the piste for local trains and headed west. Their train was only 3 cars long, and Nadia's whole crew, some 30 people, were all gathered in the first car to watch the incoming reports over the car's screen. These were official news reports from Mangalavid in South Fassa, and they were confused and inconsistent, combining regular weather reports and the like with brief accounts of strikes in many cities. Nadia kept her wrist pad in contact with either Da Vinci or the Freemars safe house in Burrows, and as they slid on, she watched both the car screen and her wrist, taking in simultaneous bursts of information as if listening to polyphonic music, finding she could track the two sources at once without any trouble, and was hungry for more. Praxis was sending up continuous reports on the Terran situation, which was confused, but not incoherent or opaque as it had been in 61. For one thing, Praxis was keeping them informed, and for another, much of the current activity on Earth was devoted to moving the coastal populations out of the reach of the floods, which so far were like very high tides, as Sax had said they would be. The metanatricide was still being played out in the form of surgical strikes and decapitation coups, commando raids and counter-raids on various corporate compounds and headquarters, combined with legal actions and PR of all sorts, including a number of suits and countersuits finally introduced to the world court, which Nadia considered encouraging. But these strategic raids and maneuvers were much reduced in the face of the global flood. And even at their worst, video of exploding compounds, airplane crash sites, stretches of road craterized by the bombing of passing limousines, they were still infinitely better than any kind of escalating war which in biological form could kill millions. As became clear, unfortunately, with a shocking report from Indonesia that came over the car's screen, a radical liberation group from East Timor, modeled on Peru's shining path, had poisoned the island of Java with an as-yet-unidentified plague so that along with the travails of the flooding there, they were losing hundreds of thousands to disease. On a continent, such a plague could become a terminal disaster, and there was no guarantee it wouldn't happen still. But meanwhile, with that one awful exception, the war down there, if that was what one called the chaos of the metanatricide, was proceeding as a fight at the top. A style similar to what they were attempting on Mars, in fact. This was comforting in a way, although if the Metanats became adept at the style, they could presumably wage it on Mars as well, if not in this first moment of surprise, then later when they had reorganized. And there was an ominous item in the flow of reports from Praxis Geneva, indicating they might be responding already. A fast shuttle with a large force of security experts had left Earth orbit from Mars 3 months ago, the report said, and was expected to reach the Martian system in a few days. The news was being released now to encourage security forces beleaguered by rioting and terrorism, according to the UN press release. Nadia's concentration on the screens was broken by the appearance of one of the big round-the-world trains on the piste beside them. 1 second they were gliding smoothly over the bumpy plateau of Ophir Plenum, and the next a big 50-car express was whooshing by them. But it didn't slow down, and there was no way of telling who, if anyone, sat behind its darkened windows. Then it was past them, and soon after that, over the horizon ahead and gone. The news shows continued at their manic pace, the reporters obviously astonished by the developments of the day. Riots in Sheffield, work stoppages in South Fassa and Hephaestus. The accounts overlapped each other in such rapid succession that Nadia found it hard to believe they were real. When they came into Underhill, Nadia's feeling of unreality persisted, for the sleepy, semi-abandoned old settlement was now abuz with activity as in M-Year 1. Resistance sympathizers had been pouring in all day from small stations around Ganges Katina and Hebe's Chasma and the north wall of Ophir Chasma. The local Bogdanovists had apparently organized them into a march on the little unit of UNTA security personnel at the train station. This had led to a standoff just outside the station itself, under the tent that covered the old arcade and the original quadrant of barrel vaults, now looking very small and quaint. So when Nadia's train pulled in, there was a loud argument going on between a man with a bullhorn surrounded by about 20 bodyguards and the unruly crowd facing them. Nadia got off the train as soon as it stopped and went over to the edge of the group hemming in the station master and his troops. She commandeered a bullhorn from a surprised-looking young woman and began shouting through it. "Station master! Station master! Station master!" She repeated this in English and Russian until everyone had gone quiet to find out who she was. Her construction team had filtered out through the crowd, and when she saw that they were positioned, she walked right up to the cluster of men and women in their flak jackets. The station master appeared to be a Mars old-timer, his face weathered and scarred across the forehead. His young team wore the Transitional Authority insignia and looked scared. Nadia let the bullhorn fall to her side and said, "I'm Nadia Chernyshevsky. I built this town, and now we're taking control of it. Who do you work for?"
"The United Nations Transitional Authority," the station master said firmly, staring at her as if she had stepped out of the grave.
"But what unit? Which metanational?"
"We're a Majari unit."
"Majari is working with China now, and China with Praxis, and Praxis with us. We're on the same side, and you don't know it yet. And no matter what you think about that, we've got you outgunned here," she shouted out to the crowd. "Everyone armed, raise their hand!" Everyone in the crowd raised their hand, and all of her crew had stun guns or nail guns or soldering beam guns in hand. "We don't want bloodshed," Nadia said to the ever-tighter knot of bodyguards before her. "We don't even want to take you prisoner. There's our train right there. You can take it and go to Sheffield and join the rest of your team. There you'll find out the new status of things. It's that or else we'll all leave the station here and blow it up. We're taking over one way or another, and it would be stupid for anyone to get killed when this revolt is already a done deal. So take the train. I'd advise going to Sheffield, where you can get a ride out on the elevator if you want. Or if you want to work for a free Mars, you can join us right now." She stared calmly at the man, feeling more relaxed than she had all day. Action was such a relief. The man ducked his head to confer with his team, and they talked in whispers for most of 5 minutes. The man looked at her again.
"We'll take your train."
And so Underhill was the first town freed. That night, Nadia went out to the trailer park, which was near the new tent coping wall. The two habitats that hadn't been turned into labs were still outfitted with the original living quarters equipment, and after inspecting them, and then going back and walking around the barrel vaults and the alchemist's quarter, she finally returned to the one she had lived in at the very start, and lay down on one of the floor mattresses feeling exhausted. It was strange indeed to lie by herself among all the ghosts, trying to feel again the presence of that distant time in her. Too strange. Despite her exhaustion, she couldn't sleep, and near dawn she had a hazy vision of worrying about uncrating goods from freight rockets and programming robot bricklayers and taking a call from Arkady on Phobos. She even slept a while in this state, dozing uneasily, until a tingling in her ghost finger woke her up. And then, rising with a groan, it was just as hard to imagine that she was waking up to a world in turmoil, with millions of people waiting to see what the day would bring. Looking around at the tight confines of her first home on Mars, it suddenly seemed to her that the walls were moving, beating very lightly, a kind of double vision, as if she were standing in the low morning light, looking through a temporal stereopticon, which revealed all four dimensions at once, with a pulsating, hallucinatory light. They breakfasted in the barrel vaults, in the large hall where Ann and Sachs had once argued the merits of terraforming. Sachs had won that argument, but Ann was out there fighting it still, as if it hadn't been decided long since. Nadia focused on the present, on her AI screen and the flood of news pouring through it this Saturday morning. The top of the screen given over to Maya's safe house in Burrows, the bottom to Praxis reports from Earth. Maya was performing heroically as usual, vibrant with apprehension, hectoring everyone in sight to conform to her vision of how things should happen, haggard and yet buzzing with her internal spin. As Nadia listened to her describe the latest developments, she chewed breakfast methodically, scarcely noticing Underhill's delicious bread. It was afternoon already in Burrows, and the day had been busy. Every town on Mars was in turmoil.
On Earth, all the coastal areas were now flooded, and the mass dislocations were causing chaos inland. The new UN had condemned the rioters on Mars as heartless opportunists who were taking advantage of a time of unprecedented suffering to advance their own selfish cause. "True enough," Nadia said to Sachs as he walked in the door, fresh from Da Vinci Crater. "They'll hold that against us later, I bet." "Not if we help them out." "Hmm." She offered him bread, regarding him closely. Despite his changed features, he was looking more like Sachs every day, standing there impassively, blinking as he looked around the old brick chamber. It seemed as though revolution was the last thing on his mind, she said. "Are you ready to fly to Elysium?" "That's what I was going to ask you." "Good. Let me go get my bag." While she was throwing her clothes and AI into her old black backpack, her wrist beeped, and there was Cassay, his long gray hair wild around his deeply lined face, which was the strangest mix of John and Hiroko. John's mouth, at the moment stretched into a wide grin, Hiroko's oriental eyes, now slitted with delight. "Hello, Cassay," Nadia said, unable to conceal her surprise. "I don't think I've ever seen you on my wrist before." "Special circumstances," he said unabashed. She was used to thinking of him as a doorman, but the outbreak of the revolution was obviously a great tonic. She understood suddenly, by his look, that he had been waiting for this all his life. "Look, Coyote and I and a bunch of Reds are up here in Chasma Borealis, and we've secured the reactor and the dam. Everyone working here has been cooperative." "Encouraging!" someone beside him yelled. "Yes, there's been a lot of support up here, except for a security team of about 100 people who are holed up in the reactor. They're threatening to melt it down unless we give them safe passage to Burrows." "So?" Nadia said. "So?" Cassay repeated and laughed. "So Coyote says we should ask you what to do." Nadia snorted. "Why do I find that hard to believe?" "Hey, no one here believes it either, but that's what Coyote said, and we like to indulge the old bastard when we can." "So, well, give them safe passage to Burrows. That's a no-brainer if I've ever seen one. It won't matter if Burrows has an extra 100 cops, and the fewer reactor meltdowns, the better. We're still waiting around in the radiation from last time." Sachs came into the room while Cassay was thinking it over. "Okay," Cassay said, "if you say so. Hey, talk to you later. I have to go. Ka." Nadia stared at her blank wrist screen, scowling. Sachs said, "What was that about?" "You've got me," Nadia said, and described the conversation while trying to call Coyote. She got no answer. Sachs said, "Well, you're the coordinator." "Shit." Nadia pulled her backpack over one shoulder. "Let's go." They flew in a new 51B, very small and very fast. They took a great circle route, which headed northwest over the Vastatas Ice Sea and avoided the Metanat strongholds of Ascrius and Echus Overlook. Very soon after takeoff, they could see the ice filling Chrysi to the north, the shattered, dirty bergs dotted with pink snow algae and amethyst melt ponds. The old transponder road to Chasma Borealis was, of course, long gone. That whole system of bringing water south forgotten, a technical footnote for the history books. Looking down at the ice chaos, Nadia suddenly remembered what the land had looked like on that first trip, the endless hills and hollows, the funnel-like oases, the great black barken dunes, the incredible laminated terrain in the last sands before the polar cap, all gone now, overwhelmed by ice. And the polar cap itself was a mess. Nothing but a collection of great melt zones and ice streams, slush rivers, ice-covered liquid lakes, every manner of slurry, and all of it crashing downslope off the high round plateau that the polar cap rested on, down into the world-wrapping northern sea. Landing was therefore out of the question for much of their flight. Nadia watched the instruments nervously, all too aware of the many things that could go wrong in a new machine during a crisis, when maintenance was down and human error up. Then billows of white and black smoke appeared on the horizon to the southwest, pouring east in what was clearly a high wind. What's that? Nadia asked, moving to the left side of the plane to look.
Cassay Valis, Sax said from the pilot's seat.
What's happened to it?
It's burning.
Nadia stared at him. What do you mean?
Heavy vegetation there in the valley, and along the foot of the great escarpment. Resonated trees and shrubs, for the most part. Also fire seed trees, you know. Species that require fire to propagate. Engineered at Biotique. Thorny resin manzanita, blackthorn, giant sequoia, some others.
How do you know this?
I planted them.
And now you've set them on fire?
Sax nodded. He glanced down at the smoke.
But Sax, isn't the percentage of oxygen in the atmosphere really high now?
40%.
She stared at him some more, suddenly suspicious. You jacked that up too, didn't you? Jesus, Sax, you might have set the whole world on fire.
She stared down at the bottom of the column of smoke. There in the big trough of Cassay Valis was a line of flame, the leading edge of the fire burning brilliant white rather than yellow. It looked like molten magnesium.
Nothing will put that out, she cried. You've set the world on fire.
The ice, Sax said. There's nothing downwind but the ice covering Chrysi. It should only burn a few thousand square kilometers.
Nadia stared at him, amazed and appalled. Sax was still glancing down at the fire, but most of the time he watched the plane's instruments, his face set in a curious expression. Reptilian, stony, utterly inhuman. The Metanat security compounds in the curve of Cassay Valis came over the horizon. The tents were all burning furiously, like torches of pitch, the craters on the inner bank like beach fire pits, spurting white flame into the air. Clearly there was a strong wind pouring down Ekkas Chasma and funneling through Cassay Valis, fanning the flames, a firestorm, and Sax stared down at it, unblinking, his jaw muscles bunched under the skin.
Fly north, Nadia ordered him. Get clear of that.
He banked the plane, and she shook her head. Thousands of square kilometers burned. All that vegetation so painstakingly introduced. Global oxygen levels raised by a significant percentage. She regarded the strange creature sitting beside her warily.
Why didn't you tell me about this?
I didn't want you to stop it.
As simple as that.
So I have that power? She said.
Yes.
Meaning I'm kept ignorant of things?
Only of this, Sax said. His jaw muscles were bunching and relaxing in a rhythm that reminded her suddenly of Frank Chalmers. The prisoners were all moved out into asteroid mining. This was the training site for all their secret police, the ones who would never give up, the torturers. He turned that lizard gaze on her. We're better off without them. And he returned to his piloting.
Nadia was still looking back at the fierce white line of the firestorm when the plane's radio beeped her code. This time it was Art, cross-eyed with worry.
I need your help, he said. Anne's people have retaken Sabishi, and a lot of the Sabishians have come up out of the maze to reoccupy it, and the Reds in control there are telling them to go away.
What?
I know. Well, I don't think Anne knows about this yet, and she isn't answering my calls. There are Reds out there that make her look like a Boonian, I swear. But I reached Ivana and Raoul and got them to stop the Reds in Sabishi till they heard from you. That's the best I could do.
Why me?
I think Anne told them to listen to you.
Shit.
Well, who else is going to do it? Maya's made too many enemies holding things together the last few years.
I thought you were the big diplomat here.
I am. But what I got was everyone agreeing to defer to your judgment. That was the best I could do. Sorry, Nadia. I'll help you any way you want me to.
You're damn well better after setting me up like this.
He grinned. It's not my fault everyone trusts you.
Nadia clicked off and tried the various Red radio channels. At first, she couldn't find Anne. But while she was running through their channels, she heard enough messages to realize that there were young Red radicals whom Anne would certainly condemn, or so she hoped,
People who, with the revolt still in the balance, were busy blowing up platforms in Vastitas, slashing tents, breaking pistes, threatening to end their cooperation with the other rebels unless they were joined in their equipage and all their demands were met, etc., etc. Finally, Anne answered Nadia's call. She looked like an avenging fury, righteous and slightly mad. "Look," Nadia said to her without preamble, "an independent Mars is the best chance you'll ever have to get what you want. You try holding the revolution hostage to your concerns and people will remember, I'm warning you. You can argue all you want once we've gotten the situation under control, but until then it's just blackmail as far as I'm concerned. It's a stab in the back. You get those Reds in Savishi to turn the city back over to its residents," Anne said angrily. "What makes you think I can tell them what to do? Who else if not you? What makes you think I disagree with what they're doing? My impression that you are a sane person, that's what. I don't presume to order people about. Reason with them if you can't order them. Tell them stronger revolts than ours have failed because of this kind of stupidity. Tell them to get a grip." Anne cut the connection without a reply. "Shit," Nadia said. Her AI continued to pour out news. The UNTA expeditionary force was coming back up from the southern highlands and appeared to be on its way to Hellas or Savishi. Sheffield was still in the control of Subarashi. Burrows was an open situation with security forces seemingly in control, but refugees were pouring into the city from Sirtis and elsewhere, and there was a general strike going on as well. The vids made it look like most of the populace was spending the day out on the boulevards and in the parks, demonstrating against the transitional authority or merely trying to watch what was going on. "We'll have to do something about Burrows," Sack said. "I know." They flew southward again, past the bump of Hecate's Tholus on the northern end of the Elysium Massif, to the South Fossa spaceport. Their flight had taken 12 hours, but they had gone west through 9 time zones and crossed the dateline at 180 degrees longitude, so it was midday Sunday when their airport bus drove to the rim of South Fossa and through the roof lock. South Fossa and the other Elysium towns, Hephaestus and Elysium Fossa, had all come out for Free Mars in a big way. They made a kind of geographical unit. A southern arm of the Vastitas ice now ran between the Elysium Massif and the Great Escarpment, and though it had already been spanned by pistes on pontoon bridges, Elysium was in the process of becoming an island continent. In all three of its big towns, crowds had poured into the streets and occupied the city offices and the physical plants. Without the threat of attacks from orbit to back them up, the few transitional authority police in the towns had either changed into civilian clothes or melted into the crowds, or else gotten on the train to Burrows. Elysium was uncontestedly part of Free Mars. Down at the Mangalavid offices, Nadia and Sax found that a large armed group of rebels had taken over the station and were now busy churning out 24.5 hours a day of video reports on all 4 channels, all sympathetic to the revolt, with long interviews from people in all the independent towns and stations. The time slip was going to be devoted to a montage of the previous day's events. Some outlying mining stations in Elysium's radial cracks and in the Phlegramontes were purely metanat operations, mostly Amex and Subarashii. These were staffed largely by new emigrants who had holed up in their camps and either gone silent or else started to threaten anyone who tried to bother them. Some even declared their intention to retake the planet or hold out until reinforcements from Earth arrived. "Ignore them," Nadia advised. "Avoid them and ignore them. Jam their communication systems if you can, and leave them alone." Reports from elsewhere on Mars were more promising. Senzeni Na was in the hands of people who called themselves Boonians, though they were not associated with Jackie. They were Issei, Nisei, Sansei, and Yonsei, who had immediately named their mohole John Boone and declared Thomasia a Dorsa Brevia peaceful neutral place. Karlyov, now a small mining town only, had revolted almost as violently as in 61, and its citizens, many of them descendants of the old prison population, had renamed the town Sergei Pavlovich Korolyov and declared it an undocumented anarchist-free zone. The old prison compounds were to be converted into a giant bazaar and communal living space with a particular welcome made to refugees from Earth. Nicosia was likewise a free city. Cairo was under the control of Amex Security. Odessa and the rest of the Hellas Basin towns were still holding firm for independence, although the Circumhellas Peace had been cut in some places. The maglev train system was bad that way. The magnetic systems had to be operating for the pistes to function and the trains to move, and these systems were easy to break. For that reason, many trains were running empty or were canceled as people took to rovers or planes to make sure they didn't get stranded in the outback somewhere in vehicles that didn't even have wheels. Nadia and Sack spent the rest of Sunday monitoring developments and making suggestions, if asked, about problem situations. In general, it seemed to Nadia that things were going well, but on Monday, bad news came in from Sabishii. The UNTA expeditionary force had arrived there from the southern highlands and retaken the surface portion of the city after a bitter all-night fight with the Red Guerrillas in control of the city. The Reds and the original Sabishians had retreated into the mound maze or the outlying shelters, and the prospect of continued bloody fighting in the maze was clear. Art predicted that the security force would be unable to penetrate the maze, and so would be forced to abandon Sabishii and train or fly up to Burrows to consolidate with the forces already there. But there was no way to be sure, and poor Sabishii was sadly battered by the assault and back in security's hands. Monday evening at dusk, Nadia went out with Sax to get something to eat. South Foss's canyon floor was thick with mature trees, the giant sequoias standing over an understory of pines and junipers, and, in the lower stretch of the canyon, aspens and canyon oaks. As they walked down the streamside park, Nadia and Sax were introduced by the Mangalavid people to group after group, most of them natives, all of them unfamiliar faces, but all very happy to meet them, it was clear. It was strange to see so many people obviously visibly happy. In normal life, Nadia realized, one simply didn't see it. Smiles everywhere, strangers talking to each other. There was more than one way for things to go when a social order disappeared. Anarchy and chaos, definitely all too possible, but also communion. They ate in an outdoor restaurant by the central stream and then returned to the Mangalavid offices. Nadia got back in front of her screen and went to work talking to as many organizing committees as she could reach. She felt like Frank in 61, working the phones in frantic overdrive. Only now they were in communication with all of Mars, and she had the distinct impression that while she was not by any means in control, she at least had a good sense of what was going on. And that was gold, that was. The iron walnut in her stomach began to shift to something more like wood. After a couple of hours, she began to fall asleep in the seconds between one call and the next. It was the middle of the night back in Underhill in Shabatana, and she hadn't slept much since the call from Sachs about Antarctica. That meant 4 or 5 days without sleep. No, wait, she figured it out. 3 days. Though it already felt like 2 weeks. She had just lain down on a couch when there was an outcry and everyone ran into the hall, then out onto the stone-flagged plaza surrounding the Mangalavid offices. Nadia stumbled blearily after Sax, who grabbed her by the arm and helped her keep her balance. Apparently there was a hole in the roof tent. People pointed, but Nadia couldn't make it out. "This is where we're better off," Sax said with a satisfied little purse of the mouth. "The pressure under the roof is only 150 millibars higher than the pressure outside." "So roofs don't pop like pricked balloons," Nadia said, remembering with a shudder some of the domed craters of 61. "And even though some outside air is getting in, it's mostly oxygen and nitrogen. Still too much CO2, but not so much that we're all poisoned instantly."
"But if the hole were bigger," Nadia said.
"True." She shook her head.
"We need to secure the whole planet to really be safe."
"True." Nadia went back inside, yawning. She sat at her screen again and began watching the four Mangalavid channels, switching among them rapidly. Most of the big cities were either openly for independence or in various kinds of stalemate, with security and control of the physical plants but nothing happening, and much of the population in the streets waiting to see what would happen next. There were a number of company towns and camps that were still supporting their metanats, but in the case of Bradbury Point and Huoxing Vallis, neighboring towns up on the Great Escarpment, their parent metanats, Amex and Majari, had been fighting each other on Earth. What effect that would have on these northern towns wasn't clear, but Nadia was sure it didn't help them to sort out their situation. There were several important towns still in the grasp of Subarashi and Amex, and these were serving as magnets for isolated Metanat and UNTA security units. Burrows was obviously chief among these, but it was true also of Cairo, Lasswitz, Sudbury, and Sheffield. In the south, the sanctuaries that hadn't been abandoned or destroyed by the expeditionary force were coming out of hiding, and Vishniak Bogdanov was building a surface tent over the old robot vehicle parking complex next to its mohole. So the south would no doubt return to its status as a resistance stronghold, for what that was worth. Nadia didn't think it was worth much. And the northern polar cap was in such environmental disarray that it almost didn't matter who held it, with most of its ice draining down into Vastatas, but the polar plateau covered by new snow every winter. It was the most inhospitable region on Mars, and there were almost no permanent settlements left up there. So the contested zone was basically the temperate and equatorial latitudes, the band around the planet bordered by the Vastatas ice to the north and the two great basins to the south. And orbital space, of course. But Sax's assault on Metanat orbital objects had apparently been a success, and his removal of Deimos from the vicinity was now looking like a happy stroke indeed. The elevator, however, was still in Metanat hands, and reinforcements from Earth were due any time, and Sax's team and Da Vinci had apparently used up most of their weaponry in the initial attack. As for the Saleta and the annular mirror, they were so big and fragile that they were impossible to defend. If someone wanted to wreck them, they probably could. But Nadia didn't see the reason for it. If it happened, she would immediately suspect Reds on their own side of doing it. And if they did, well, everyone could get by without that extra light, as they had before. She would have to ask Sax what he thought about that, and talk to Anne about it, see what her position was, or maybe it was better not to put ideas in her head. She would have to see how it went. Now what else? She fell asleep with her head on the screen. When she woke again, she was on the couch, ravenous, and Sax was reading her screen. "It's looking bad in Sabishi," he said when he saw her struggling up. She went to the bathroom, and when she came back, she looked over his shoulder and read as he talked. "Security couldn't deal with the maze, so they've left for Burrows. But look!" He had two images on screen. On top, one of Sabishi, burning as ferociously as Kasey Vallis had. On bottom, troops flooding into the train station in Burrows, wearing light body armor and carrying automatic weapons, their fists punching the air. Burrows was filled with groups of these security forces, it seemed, and they had taken over Branch Mesa and Double-Decker Butte for their residential quarters. So along with the UNTA troops in the city, there were now security teams from both Subarashi and Majari. In fact, all the big metanats were represented, which caused Nadia to wonder about what was really going on between them on Earth, whether they hadn't come to some sort of agreement or ad hoc alliance as a result of the crisis. She called up Art in Burrows to ask him what he thought. "Maybe these Martian units are so cut off that they're making their own peace," he said. "They might be completely on their own." "But if we're still in contact with Praxis..." "Yeah, but we surprised them. They weren't aware of the extent of sympathy for the Resistance, and so we got the drop on them. Maya's strategy of lying low paid off in that sense. No, these teams could very well be on their own right now. In which case, we could consider Mars to be independent already and in the midst of a civil war over who has control here. I mean, if those people in Burrows call us up and say, okay, Mars is a world, it's big enough for more than one kind of government, you have yours and we have Burrows, don't try to take ours away from us, what are we going to say?
I don't think anyone in Metanat security is thinking that big, Nadia said. It's only been 3 days since things fell apart on them. She pointed to the TV screen. See, look, there's Derek Hastings, head of the Transitional Authority. He was head of Mission Control in Houston when we flew out, and he's dangerous, smart, and very stubborn. He'll just hold on until those reinforcements land.
So what do you think we should do?
I don't know.
Can we just leave Burrows alone?
I don't think so. We'd be much better off if we came out from behind the sun with a completed takeover. If there are beleaguered Terran troops holding out heroically in Burrows, they're almost sure to come out and save them. Call it a rescue mission and then go for the whole planet.
It won't be easy to take Burrows with all those troops in it.
I know.
Sax had been asleep on another couch across the room, and now he opened one eye. The Reds are talking about flooding it.
What?
It's below the level of the Vastatas ice, and there's water under the ice. Without the dike...
No, Nadia said. There's 200,000 people in Burrows, and only a few thousand security troops. What are the people supposed to do? You can't evacuate that many people. It's crazy. It's 61 all over again.
The more she thought about it, the angrier she got.
What can they be thinking?
Maybe it's just a threat, Art said over the screen.
Threats don't work unless the people you're threatening believe you'll carry them out.
Maybe they will believe it. Nadia shook her head.
Hastings not that stupid. Hell, he could evacuate his troops by way of the spaceport and let the population drown, and then we become monsters, and Earth would be more certain than ever to come after us. No!
She got up and went looking for some breakfast, then discovered, looking at the row of pastries in the kitchen, that her appetite was gone. She took a cup of coffee and went back to the office, watching her hands shake. In 2061, Arcadi had been faced with a splinter group which had sent a small asteroid on a collision course with the Earth. It was meant to be a threat only. But the asteroid had been blown apart in the biggest human-created explosion in history, and after that the war on Mars had suddenly become deadly in a way that it hadn't been before, and Arcadi had been helpless to stop it. And it could happen again. She walked back into the office. We have to go to Burrows, she said to Sax.
This ends side 2 of cassette 18 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 19.